Start.
Check, 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 check.
Check, check, check. Okay.
Check!
And if I do this, perfect, 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 perfect. Okay, here we go.
You watch movies?
Yeah, I watch movies. Do you watch movies? No, I watched...
yeah, sometimes I watch movies.
I watched Batman Begins.
Light on me.
And The Dark Knight. Two consecutive nights.
Wow.
I was really in a Batman and like a Chris Nolan mood. I was like...
Yeah?
Really don't want to watch those movies. Because I think those might be... Those two... Well, no. Yeah, those two are in my top four Nolans, I think.
Yeah, they're pretty solid.
Yeah, I'd say they're really good.
Especially Dark Knight. Big fan of Dark Knight.
That's my least favorite of the trilogy.
Oh, really?
I think, well, I can't tell, because this time I really liked it. Because, like, Harvey Dent is such a good character. Like, man, that movie is good. That it's so good. But Batman Begins is also, like, a super good origin story as far as they go. And Dark Knight Rises, I think a lot of people didn't like as much, but I love Tom Hardy as Bane.
Yeah,
was a great way to finish the series, I think. And Anne Hathaway was really good in it too. But those are good movies. I also, it is funny. I think I was also like wanting to watch Spielberg because I was just thinking about Spielberg because of what we're watching this week or what we're talking about today. And I watched Saving Private Ryan the other day. Which is pretty unbelievable. It's I don't know, definitely not my favorite by him, but the level of detail in his movies. There's a scene and there's like I can't stop thinking about this one moment where they're invading Normandy, they're on the beach, and a medic is helping someone who got blown up, and he gets shot in the leg through his canteen. And this is like some side character that's in the background of the shot who doesn't have any lines. But in his canteen, water starts dripping out of it, and then blood starts dripping out of it.
Oh.
So it's like with this minor character that doesn't have any lines, and that's in the background of a scene while someone else is talking that's more important, they took the time to have a squib blow up on a canteen and have water shoot out of the canteen and then blood after that. It's like they took the time to put this detail, and it's like so incredible. It's it's crazy. Spielberg's nuts, and I think that comes through in Raiders of the Lost Ark, which is what we're talking about today, but it definitely comes through in something higher budget like Saving Private Ryan.
I also gotta add in real quick, yet again for the second straight episode in the middle of a thunderstorm. So if you hear any loud cracks that might scare you, I apologize. They're scaring me as well. So we're in this together. Hopefully nothing bad happens. Going back to the Batman, I mean, that trilogy, like Christian Bale as Batman is just like such a great character. I mean, that trilogy is full of really great characters. Liam Neeson and Begins
as Ra's al Ghul,
Heath Ledger is great. Like you said, Tom Hardy and Anne Hathaway and that other dude from The Dark Knight.
Gary Oldman as Christopher Gordon. Gary Oldman's great.
Cillian
Murphy as Scarecrow. Marion Cotillard as Talia. Yeah,
you know me, I'm just really bad with names.
Yeah, you gotta get on that, man.
I know, dude, that's bad.
Did you get on it for Raiders of the Lost Ark? Did you learn the names?
No, I just know Indiana Jones, that's it.
Okay, well, I'm gonna have to have a sit down with you and some flashcards.
I watched the first half of A Star Is Born last night.
Okay.
And I got tired and then I went to sleep.
Okay.
But I really liked the performance of Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga in that. Especially Bradley Cooper just in a singing role. Mm-hmm. Like, I remember hearing stories about how he underwent like a bunch of training for that
Yeah.
And just like how much his voice was transformed for that role was really cool. But yeah, it's a solid movie.
That's one of the few movies that's made me sob.
Yeah.
Have you seen it?
It's okay. It's a sad movie.
Yeah. That's a really good movie. And it's funny because that's been remade. That I guess this one's either the third or fourth one. I'll say third.
Yeah.
And that's interesting. Like, it's become like a meme to remake it almost. And that's really an interesting movie because Bradley Cooper came to a studio with the idea like, hey, can I be in A Star Is Born? Let's redo it. And they're like, I don't know about that. How about you go write the script and like develop it?
Mm.
And he did. And then he directed it and he starred in it. And it's just nuts. It's so much talent. And yeah, Lady Gaga too, just her acting and super impressive. It's all super impressive.
Yeah. I think that was my only movie of the week, TBH, other than Indiana Jones, of course.
Gotcha.
I think I mentioned last week I watched both the Wonder Womans.
You did. Well, maybe not on the
podcast.
I
don't know if I mentioned it. Yeah. I watched both the Wonder Womans. The first one's actually pretty solid. Second one, it's not so good, I would say. But
hey, do you think Endgame is a better movie than The Dark Knight?
Yeah.
All right. So, anything else to report before we break for an ad?
You got something to say or
no? Nothing. Why?
It's a tough decision. As you can see, I froze up a little bit, but I don't know. It's for me. That's like one that's very difficult to compare. But
two superhero movies.
Yeah. But it's just like I don't know. Like Dark Knight is the second installment of a Batman film, like a Batman standalone film, and Endgame is the culmination of 21 films.
That's true.
There's a lot more character stuff going on in Endgame than there is, and there's a lot more fan service going on in.
There's more character stuff going on in Endgame than in Dark Knight.
Not like
amount of characters.
Gotcha. They have a lot more ground to cover than in Batman.
Okay. Yeah. All right, okay. Well,
yeah.
I was just curious. Anything else to report?
No, I don't. How's life?
Everything good?
Everything is all right. Yep. The Sparks are struggling a little bit.
Okay.
Like I said, we've lost both our star players, but we're trying our best.
I have faith that you can bring them back, Aiden.
Yeah. That's what my dad said. He was like, Aiden, you need to do better. You need to start bringing home the W's.
Why do you think they hired you?
I'll try. The graphics, they need to be stepped up a little bit. They need to be better.
Absolutely.
That's how the game results are determined. But.
All right. Well, let's break for an ad real quick, and we'll be right back with Raise the Lost Ark. In a sudden change of events, Aiden's actually going to tell another story before we get into Raise the Lost Ark. So let's hear it, Aiden.
I just got a text from maybe Jake. I don't know. That's what my iPhone said. But these guys, they keep messaging me, and these people start... There's this like knife selling company.
Oh yeah.
It's called Cutco, I think.
Yeah, Cutco.
But for some reason, like a bunch of people that I went to high school with and like I met in high school or whatever, they're like getting tied up in Cutco, which you know, good for them because from the text that I got, their starting base pay is $17 an hour, and the schedule's pretty super flexible. You can work as little as 1 to 2 days a week. But I will tell you, I have just been hounded by Cutco. They are just looking to hire people left and right, especially me.
Maybe this is a sign from God to say bye to the Sparks and start selling knives.
It's super weird because like I'm getting a text and it seems like it's from an actual person, and then at the end of the text it says, "Just text." Quote all caps stop and I will send you more and I won't send you more info. It's super weird, man.
Have you done that yet? Have you texted stop?
No, I just got the text and I decided to pay more attention to what we're doing here. Okay. But you know what? If you work for Cutco, good for you. You know, $17, that's a good amount. I just have other stuff going on.
Thank you for the offer, though. I appreciate it. Yep. I hope Jake's not listening. Cutco.
I'm sorry, Jake. But you know what? Cutco, maybe down the line, if things clear up a little bit, maybe the stars will align and we can get some work done together.
I keep getting texts from a Raphael telling me about new apartments in the city that are opening up.
Oh yeah. It's like, wow.
I've texted him before. I'm like, hey, this, you have the wrong number. And I keep getting texts from Raphael. He said every time, it's, hello, this is Raphael. Raphael, please.
He's like, no, I don't have the wrong number, actually.
No, Michael, this was meant for you. But yeah, let's get into the movie. I picked this one, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Indiana Jones, from 1981, directed by Steven Spielberg, written by Lawrence Kasdan, who wrote and directed The Big Chill, but that was the only thing I saw of his that I recognize. Cinematography by Douglas Slocum. I picked this because I wanted to include Spielberg. It felt wrong to not include Spielberg in the movies that we're doing. Feels kind of quintessential, like a fairly low budget for a Spielberg movie. The budget was $20 million, but you know, was huge box office, and still today is famous. And in my opinion, from watching it, all the effects and, you know, the action holds up pretty well today. But yeah.
Yeah.
Any initial thoughts about the movie, Aiden?
Yeah, actually, I will say this is the first time that I've ever watched it in full.
First time I ever watched it. I was like, no way.
No. I've seen little bits and pieces of it because it's a film that I've mentioned before on the pod that my dad is someone who rewatches the same movies over and over and over again. And this is one of them. So whenever he has it playing in the kitchen or something, I'll like walk downstairs into the kitchen and I watch like 5 minutes of it and then I go back to my room or whatever. So I've like some of the parts I recognize, some of it was new to me. But overall, pretty solid film. Like you said, it's like quintessential Spielberg, like one of the classics. Also, like you said, a lot of the stuff still holds up well today. I will say there were some like effects and stuff that were kind of weird, but it's like 1981, so I'll give it a pass. There were a lot of explosions, which seems like a classic Spielberg thing, pretty sure. Is that him or is that Michael Bay?
That's Michael. Very different directors, but yeah, that's Michael Bay.
I know. I forget. I can't remember which Spielberg, one it is that's big on explosions.
But, I mean, thinking literally just about, Saving Private Ryan, I mean, lots of explosions in that as well. Jurassic Park, I don't think, has that many explosions, but yeah, there were a number.
That has dinosaurs. It doesn't need explosions.
Jaws has a massive shark, and there's an explosion in that movie. So
there's only one Jaws, you know? There's only one shark.
That's true. Well, whereas that's what you think.
I think Harrison Ford's performance is really solid. How old was he when he filmed this?
I think in his 30s.
Off the top of your head? Okay. Yeah, so this is like kind of like the start of his career for him.
His first movie, I think, was American Graffiti, which George Lucas directed. This is after, when was Star Wars? 79?
I'll look it up. Keep talking.
Yeah, so this was 1981. Blade Runner was 82, which is like one of his biggest things. Yes, episode 4, Star Wars, A New Hope, was 77. So he had done
A
number of things before this movie. But yeah, pretty early as far as like his famous stuff. And American Graffiti was 73, so 8 years before.
Yeah. But during some research,
An Apocalypse Now was 79, so also 2 years before.
Okay. I like bit my tongue mid sentence. I did some research before watching, come to discover that George Lucas is basically like his idea at first. And
kind of, yeah.
It was his idea, and then he went to Spielberg. They kind of grew it together, and then George Lucas had to back off a little bit because he was doing Star Wars at the time, which is interesting because basically George Lucas and Harrison Ford are like in it together, like did the Star Wars together, did Indiana Jones together, something else you mentioned, I forget.
Harrison Ford's, I think maybe his first performance was American Graffiti, which George Lucas directed. It's a, like a 1950s high schooler movie.
Yeah, so apparently our friends Harrison and George go way back, which is cool. That's like overarching stuff for me. I have some like specific things to talk about later on, but
I mentioned the writer, but George Lucas adapted the story with someone else from a movie called Secret of the Incas, which was from 1954, and it was like an explorer movie with Charlton Heston in it, actually. And I don't even think Charlton Heston was the character that Indiana Jones was based off of. I think there was like another explorer character in it. But anyway, like, yeah, some 50s explorer movie that no one's ever heard of sparked the idea for Indiana Jones. And you mentioning that kind of makes me happy that Spielberg did get on board and not George Lucas. Not to say anything bad about George Lucas, because he did bring us Star Wars and American Graffiti is pretty good and he's done some cool stuff, but certainly wouldn't be the same movie without Spielberg on it. But yeah, I guess I'll get into like opening stuff. I mean, I vividly remember watching this the first time. I think I...
Me too.
Yeah, for real. And I want to talk to you about like how different was it watching it as one piece as opposed to like the bits and pieces. But I'll just say like... I don't really think in terms of like... what's the movie that got me into film and film school and everything like that. But, like, I think I would have to put this on the list as far as live action goes. Because, like, there's a lot of animation I watched as a kid, a ton. Like, especially like, stop motion stuff that I really loved. But, like, live action stuff, like, I remember really being obsessed with this movie and watching with my dad. And, like, that first scene is so memorable. Even before, like, the boulder rolls, which is obviously the iconic image that you get. But that first scene is so well done in so many ways, of them walking through the jungle on their way to the tomb. They very deliberately don't show you Indiana Jones's face for a good few minutes. And I remember as a kid being like, is this random guy, Indiana Jones? I think his name is Satipo, the, Alfred Molina's character. I thought like that was Indiana Jones, like the guy that gets killed by the spikes immediately, but and then like because they keep it from you who Indiana Jones is, and so just a great job not showing his face and just teaching you, similar to La La Land and how they introduce the characters and show a lot about them, you find out a lot about this character even before seeing his face. You see him walking ahead of the pack first of all, and how he's completely like unfazed by the statue with the bats flying out of it after that first guy was scared by it. And this happens again later in the movie. Indiana Jones just like walks by it, doesn't give it a second thought. He walks up to the poison dart and feels the end of the poison dart, then throws it on the ground because he has his information that he needs from it. And then after he's done, two of the other explorers run up behind him and they have to taste it in order to figure it out. And I think there's a difference between like Indiana Jones just feeling it and then the other two coming up and tasting it and you know, getting information from it. And then like you have the moment that the one explorer behind him pulls the gun on him, and then Indiana Jones has the instinct to turn around and use his whip. And you introduce, like, the use of the whip for the rest of the movie and the rest of the four movies, you know. But also, like, just shows, yeah, that instinct that he has. And yeah, just like the way he's fearless walking into the tomb, like, these things are all very well established with zero dialogue. The spiders, the booby traps, everything. So, yeah, just a very vivid visual storytelling scene to start the movie off. Yeah,
I feel like that opening scene is definitely super iconic. I've seen the scene before, and like I knew what it was when I was watching it, obviously. But like, just thinking about how he takes the bag of sand and like replaces it with the whatever that thing is. What's the official term for it?
I don't know the name of the thing, but like the statuette, I guess.
A gold skull, gold skull or something, whatever. But whenever he does a little switcheroo, like that's like an iconic thing that even though I hadn't seen Indiana Jones before, like I knew what that was.
Absolutely.
Like, whenever you're a kid, you know, you play these imaginary games of like booby traps and things like that. Yeah. And that's like something that you would do. And it's cool that, I mean, that moment, and there were a lot of other moments throughout the film that happened where they just seem like iconic moments that are carried through, like, off the screen, like, through families to children and blah, 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 and, it, like, gets used frequently. I was also interested that, like, this guy is super fearless, right? And he's like, oh, poison dart, psh, whatever. And then he runs into a snake and he like loses his mind.
Yeah, no, totally.
Definitely like, it's like an interesting character point. Like he's not scared of, he's not fearless of everything, you know?
Right.
He's like a little bit human, you know?
Yeah, you know, absolutely. There's something that grounds him. And I think that that's very much needed in a story where this character, who's a university professor, is willing to go, like, and is aware that he's going to fight Nazis to try to uncover the lost Ark of the Covenant. And yeah, you need something to ground him. And that's another, like, cool example of, like, I mean, it's not that cool, I guess, but, like, they did show, you know, the snake in the cockpit of the plane. And then later that comes up, obviously, in Cairo. And in a great scene in the tomb, yeah, that definitely is like needed information.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah, just interesting. Like, I feel like Indiana Jones being a university professor, like, and him being this—I don't even know like what title to give Indiana Jones, like the one that goes hunting treasure or whatever. it almost felt like a superhero movie to me. Like, basically he's like a Bruce Wayne, but like not like a bat.
Right. Yeah, that's rich. True.
Which is interesting. Like just seeing like that same, I guess, parallel. I don't know.
Totally.
In the film with this guy who is just hunting treasure in the like 30s, 40s. Just so he can have stuff in museums and try and learn more about history or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. That's true. A good comparison to like a superhero, like it's definitely like an alter ego. And I wrote down like there is such a, it's such like an interesting juxtaposition between like, he's an archaeologist, explorer, whatever he's doing in the first scene, running, being chased by a boulder. And then the next, very next scene after he gets on a plane, while running away from people trying to kill him, he's in a classroom teaching. And it's a little funny. It's interesting. It says a lot about the character. It shows that I think it's important that he is respectful to the job that he's carrying out. Because I think that was a big difference in the movie between the Nazis and Indiana Jones. And then at the end, Indiana Jones versus the government that takes the Ark away from the museum. It's like he has a respect for these things. And he's tested at the one point while he's holding the RPG, threatening to blow up the Ark. You know, he, Belloc tells him, you know, this is a piece of history. You can't blow it up. And he agrees with him. And yeah, just him being a professor and him is kind of just, I think, a way of showing that he does like have the respect. And that's like the drive that he needs to go on these expeditions. Because I think without like him working at a school and being a professor, I think you wouldn't even really have the reason for him to want to go on these missions. Otherwise, he would be like just a government agent who's going to get it for the U.S. to keep it away from the Nazis, when that is kind of the point, but it's also like the respect of it. So, yeah, it's super interesting that he is a professor. I think also in those school scenes, and it's important to note, and this is kind of a theme throughout that I have written down. It's interesting. My notes are kind of formatted like by scene. It's like, I haven't done this really yet, but it's like Cairo, school, the opening scene, tomb, like stuff like that. Again, this is like kind of something I'm going to talk about throughout, and this is something that my brother sent me about a week ago. Steven Soderbergh, director of Ocean's 11, wrote this article, like a blog post, about Raiders of the Lost Ark, and he has a copy of Raiders of the Lost Ark embedded in the blog post that's in black and white with no sound, and he changed the music as well. He like put his own music in, and he's saying, watch this movie and you'll be able to tell what's going on without any dialogue and without any color and without the right music. And that's so true, down to conversations, down to two guys from the U.S. government coming to the school and sending him on his expedition. You know, by the way they look, by their suits, you know their personality without words being spoken, and you know that they have a different motive than Indiana Jones likely has, and you know what's going on. He opens up the book and shows them the picture of the Ark. He draws the staff on the board instead of just talking about to them. Things are made so much more interesting by the visuals. And that really came through in that scene. Because I was thinking about it, it's like, wow, even in this scene that's straight dialogue, it's one of the few scenes in the movie that's straight dialogue, it's even very meticulously thought through and easy to tell what's going on through the visuals. That scene also sets up like the falling out with Professor Ravenwood, which is the fact that Indiana Jones had a relationship with Marion. And then, but they don't reveal that at this point. I just thought that was funny. I hadn't noticed that in the past, but yeah.
Yeah. I'm interested to hear what you have to say about, just the, cinematography of the film. I feel like, especially in action films, it's like kind of hard to get to like pay attention to the action that's going on and also pay attention to cinematography, at least in my personal experience. So I'm curious as to what you think of the cinematography of the film, whether it's like something extraordinarily special or if it's more about the action. But you've seen it several times, so I feel like you probably have a better analysis. So,
yeah, totally. Good question. I think it is pretty special. It's not super flashy. It's not like, things don't pop out at you the way that they do in La La Land, let's say. And that's so much more stylistic than Indiana Jones is. But I think there's special things about this movie. It's also shot anamorphic, first of all. We talked about anamorphic, how the negative is stretched technically, and it gives you a widescreen. This movie was released, it was shot on a Panavision camera and with a Panavision anamorphic lens, and several of them, lots of different focal lengths, and was released in 2.31:1 and 2.2:1 widescreen. There's some thunder
right there.
If you guys heard that from Aiden. But I think like the biggest testament to it being good cinematography is like, yes, you saw a couple of anamorphic flares that stretch all the way across the screen, especially towards the end of the movie. and like there are some pretty things going on, but I think the biggest testament is that it holds up visually today. Like, and it really does. It doesn't look like an 80s movie to me. And that's just so cool to see that that's the case, because I think even Jaws, I think, looks a little bit older. It's from a few years earlier. It's from the late 70s, and you can kind of tell, but this movie just feels so current. And it's also a period piece. It takes place in the late 1930s, I believe, and was filmed in 1981. And it doesn't... I think with a lot of period pieces, especially something as stylized as the 50s, like the 80s, you very much notice that it's a period piece. But with this, you don't even think about it. You just accept that it's 1930s and it feels right. And I think that's like not that easy to pull off. And I think that's done through the cinematography. There's interesting deep focus, which is something that you don't see in movies a lot. You kind of try to achieve a shallow depth of field because it's more cinematic. But you see a lot of times in this movie, there's an object very close to the camera that's in focus and an object that's far away from the camera in focus. You see this in the jungle when Indiana Jones holds a map up and you see one of the other explorers in the background, both in focus. I thought that was interesting. And a couple of scenes later, or a couple moments later, when Belloc is holding the golden statue in his hands and laughing as Indiana Jones flees for his life, the statue is so close to the screen it's in focus, and Belloc's face is also in focus. And that happens again throughout the movie, more times throughout the movie. So that was really interesting. Good use of shadow, darkness. I haven't really thought about this in a while, I guess, on the podcast, with Endgame and then Ratatouille and then La La Land, which is relatively bright. I guess for a musical, it's pretty dark, but I just didn't think about it during that because there was so much else to talk about. But really good use of shadows, cuchulores, which are like cutouts. You have a lot of different scenes when a grid pattern, or in Cairo, there's some fancy ornate patterns of wood in the houses that light shining through and casting it like a pattern. And that's just so simple, but so it adds a lot to the image. That's the cuchulores effect. And strong casting of shadows. I love the moment when he walks into the bar in Nepal, and his shadow with his hat is cast up on the wall, and then moments later the Nazis walk in the room and they're cast up on the wall in front of Marion, and or when he uncovers, when they go down and they see the Ark, and they first walk up to the stone casing on top of it, and his hat is casting a shadow onto the Ark. It's just really cool to see the use of not only shadow, literally darkness on the character, but also the where they're casting shadows was well used as well. I mean, yeah, I think good cinematography, it's not like editing. It's said that like good editing, you don't notice good editing. That's like what good editing is. You're not supposed to notice it. I don't really think that's what cinematography is. I think you notice good cinematography, and maybe you don't really know, or you can't articulate what you're liking about it or how it makes you feel, but you definitely notice it. There were definitely moments in this where I did notice it, not like as many as La La Land, let's say, but there's still such good cinematography working with directing where, and I have some moments here written down where there's a lot of information conveyed to you in one frame because of the way it's framed up. I saw this as well in Saving Private Ryan, where there's like a character in one side of the screen and there's a lot going on in another area, like I kind of said earlier, but that wasn't really the example I'm talking about. It's like information about the story is conveyed, and that's the same here. You know, you in the bar scene, you can easily show a shot of the hot embers on the end of the fire stoker that the Nazi's holding, Major Arnold Tote is holding, but you can also show it for the first time with Marion being held by the other guys, thugs, in the background. You know, it's like you can heighten the drama by showing Marion's relationship to this danger coming towards her rather than showing them separately. So in that way, the cinematography is impressive, and that has so much to do with directing as well. That's on Spielberg as well. So yeah, those are my thoughts on cinematography. What did you think about it?
Yeah, I kind of hinted at it, but it felt difficult for me to kind of pay attention to the cinematography
within action film.
And I, you know, it's been like that for, we talked about it in Endgame, how there's not really that many like crazy cinematic moments.
Mm-hmm.
But like even in that one, like there's in like the action scenes, it's kind of hard to pay attention to that just because of what's going on.
Sure.
But I think what you said about just like the dating of it, I would agree with you. It does not feel like a film from 1981. Like if I had to date it, I'd probably say like mid to late 90s maybe.
Yeah.
Just because of the quality. Like if the quality was better, like the camera quality, sure, like the I would probably talk, put it in like the 2000s. Yeah. But even with the film being placed in 1930s, like, I feel like it's very easy as an audience to be told that at the beginning. And then I don't know if it's like, I guess what I'm thinking is you're told that it's the 1930s and the camera quality would have been like that in the 1930s or something. It's obviously much better than it would have been in the 1930s, mm-hmm. but it almost feels like a pass, you know, for the film being that far back in time. I don't know if that makes sense or not, or if that's like whatever, but like, I just feel like it's not, I'm not like saying that's a bad thing or anything. It's just, I mean, I'm sure that there's other films as well, but you get the sense that there's, a lower quality and it's okay because it's dated back so much older. I don't know.
Maybe I don't know that
impacts the experience or anything,
right? And I don't know that that would have been the case at the time, especially. I think this probably looked top notch, you know, in 1981.
Yeah, definitely.
And I think what I meant too about like the time period and the fact that it takes place in the 30s is you watch something like American Graffiti, and you have like pink cars and like drive-in movies and drive-in diners, and like everything, and like the outfits and everything like is hyper stylized to the 50s. I'm trying to think, like Wonder Woman 1984, hyper stylized to the 1980s. You're aware that you're watching something that like is supposed to be 50s or I'm sorry, 80s. But I feel like with this movie, I never stopped to think this is supposed to be the 1930s. Maybe because it's not so clear as like the 50s or 70s or 80s. Maybe that's the case, and it's like not fair to make this comparison. But it's very subtle in terms of costume design and set design, and it almost feels as if that's the way that it should be. That's just my thought on that.
I feel like even with the time period and just like where they're at, I feel like if you said that it took place anywhere between 1930 and 1980, it would make sense. Like, except for the Nazis,
right? Except for the main,
like you place any other villain in there, and it makes sense. Like anywhere in that time period. So,
I think it's true.
Speaking of which, I noticed the interesting plot point of like how the Nazis are kind of the main villain. And I've noticed that in a lot of films recently. Examples, Wonder Woman. I guess that wasn't really the Nazis, because I think that was World War One, if I'm not mistaken.
World War One, yes. Recall. So it was the Germans, but not the Nazis, yeah.
Yeah. And then in Captain America First Avenger, Hydra is kind of... I'm pretty sure that they're... like a branch
and
out of
Hydra, like, and like modern day Nazis in right. like Winter Soldier.
Right. And so it's interesting that, I've noticed like Nazis and Germans and stuff being kind of just placed there as the villains. And I don't know if that's because of films being dated back to that time period for sake of a war or for sake of, you know, some American figure needing to beat a bad guy in an old timey film. I was curious on your take on that and if there's any specific reason that shows up frequently or if it's just a...
I can't say. I don't want to like... I like... That's a big kind of thing to tackle and like, what do I know? And well, yeah, if I'm being frank, like... But I guess, what do I think? I mean, certainly the Nazis are an easy target, like, as they should be. Like, the Nazis will always be evil, except for this one propaganda film that the Nazis made that, like, is apparently, like, the one Nazi thing that's, like, true art that, like... And I had a professor that showed it to us, like, this, like, Nazi propaganda and, like, how good of a film it was. And he was very clear, like, that we're not siding with the Nazis, but look at this thing they did. And I had another professor that was like, I refuse to show that in my class or like pretend that that's good. And so like that's a tangent. That's beside the point. But what I'm saying is, the Nazis were and are bad people. And I think are, honestly easy to make the villain. I'm not sure beyond that. I'm not sure what was going on in 1981. They would prompt Spielberg to make the Nazis a villain, honestly, other than placing the movie during World War II. I don't know. He absolutely, he's Jewish. He also did Saving Private Ryan, where the Nazis are also the villain. Also did Schindler's List, obviously centered around you know, the atrocities that occurred in Europe at the time. So, you know, it's no doubt that's a part of, you know, his voice and his filmmaking as well. But like, yeah, in terms of like, why are the Nazis always the bad guys? Like, well, because they are bad guys. And also, but I can't speak for every filmmaker ever, not even Spielberg, for why they actually picked them. So I'm not going to try to.
Yeah, I think the Wonder Woman and the Captain America kind of makes sense because those are two characters that are pretty based on war and just placing them in a time of war, like especially a world war. That makes sense, I guess. Indiana Jones, I was kind of questioning it a little bit. Just because the film could have taken place at any time. But who knows? I'll let you talk.
I mean, lots of great things in this movie still, like Marion's introduction, her drinking game she's playing, and they're placing bets on who's going to win, her versus a huge overweight guy, and she wins, you know, like what better character introduction to show how tough she is, you know, and what she's going to be like for the rest of the movie, you know, she really isn't your typical, leading lady, which, you know, the Indiana Jones movies really do change up on you a lot, because you have Willie Scott in Temple of Doom, which is just not a great character, but then you have Elsa Schneider in Last Crusade, who's a great character and ends up being on the side of the Nazis herself. Sorry, spoilers. But Marion had such a good character introduction, and she's such a good character and is so fun. Like, you could easily have such a boring character to play opposite the main character. And I guess you could say this about any movie, but she is so entertaining. She adds so much to the movie. And I think on while talking about her, it's so great the way they crafted history between characters. They didn't need any setup time to show you that Marcus Brody walking in his classroom at the beginning, showing that they had a history together, showing that Indiana Jones and Marcus just had chemistry and were good friends, and they didn't need time to tell you that or like lay out their history together. Same with Marion, obviously. She punches him when she first sees him. They talk briefly about their past and how she was so young and didn't know what she was doing, and like that he's responsible for that. Like, there's such rich history just in, like, a couple lines, or just in a look between characters, or just in small interactions. That's the same goes for Sala and Cairo, played by John Rhys-Davies, who is Gimli. I looked it up, and Gimli in Lord of the Rings, the actor John Rhys-Davies is 6'1". So the character that plays the dwarf in the movie is 6'1", which I just thought was funny. Anyway, yeah, great history. Belloc as well. It's like, you know that he's rivals with this French archaeologist, Belloc, and, you know, instantly when he rolls out away from the stone covered in spider webs, it's clear that there's a knowledge between them, and a history. So that was really well done. It's kind of refreshing almost to be able to sit down and watch the first of a franchise and not feel like you're being crammed information about backstories, because it's all there for you. I kind of talked a little bit about this already, but, you know, such an atmospheric scene. The bar scene, you have all the people at first with the drinking game, and it was like a fun moment. And then they all leave, and the atmosphere completely changes. There's wind blowing outside. It's snowing in Nepal. You like feel that. And there's smoke in the air from the fireplace, and the glow from the lamps in the fireplace and the candles. And it's quiet, and it's such a different atmosphere when Indiana Jones walks in from when the whole crowd was in there. And that changes again when the Nazis come in, and there's like tension in the air. And that was so well emphasized from the atmosphere of the bar. And it's a difficult thing to do, to really think through, what is this space going to look like? How does that improve my story? And that happens throughout the whole movie, where if for $20 million, you have some great props, set dressing, just great elements to the production design. He's standing on a submarine at one point. They're on cars. They blow up a plane. Like, there is some crazy stuff going on in this movie that should be commended, I think. Yeah, I already said that. Yeah, I already talked about the fire stoker with the ember on it, and just showing a lot of information in one frame and heightening tension through showing multiple people and objects in one frame. Yeah, should I keep going? Are you going to jump in? Or?
Yeah, I'll jump in. There were a lot of, I kind of touched on it earlier, like just iconic moments. A little bit differently, there were a lot of moments that felt kind of cliche, and I don't know if they were cliche because
of the movie
has been out for 40 years, and that's like the original of the cliche. But like Indiana Jones' fear of snakes, like that seems like a cliche thing. And whenever the first scene when he's in the temple, is that the correct term?
Tomb, temple, I don't even know.
Whatever. Whenever the guy he goes in with takes the whip off the tree, and he's like, "Oh, I'll toss it to you if you toss me the prized possession," and eventually his hand is forced and he has to do that, or else, you know, they get trapped or whatever. And then that betrayal happens, and you're like, "Wow, I saw that coming," you know. Mm-hmm. And then Harrison Ford's character jumps around the corner, and the dude gets cut by spikes, and like, I saw that one coming as well. Like, karma hits you hard. And there were just, I mean, so many other moments. The one where Indiana Jones brings a gun to a sword fight, that's like, I feel like that's a meme. I feel like I've seen it on Instagram before.
Right.
One of those movie clip Instagram accounts. But even the saying, like, bring a gun to a knife fight or fist fight or whatever, I don't even know where that comes from, but I feel like it's got to come from this.
It could be maybe, like, yeah.
Maybe this is just a play on that. Maybe, I don't know. But there was like the part where they actually get in the tomb, and they are getting it out, and somehow this dude just happens to see these guys over the hill, and he's like, "Oh, it's him!" Like, I feel like they could have done a better job of not getting caught, and also like it seems unrealistic that they were just like just perched out making all this ruckus or whatever. Like, I feel like they would have been more discreet. I don't know. One more thing, and I'll let you talk. I think just Indiana Jones' character, like, we talked before about just the parallel between him as a professor and him as a thrill-seeking treasure hunter. But he feels like a guy who is often very lucky, but is also very skilled at what he does and is super smart about what he does and, you know, knows how to solve problems and how to get out of, you know, sticky situations. But there were also several times where he just got insanely lucky on stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And you're sitting there like, oh, of course that happened. Like, of course he got out of that one, you know, unscathed.
Right.
But it's just interesting. Like, obviously he's a very smart guy. He's like, he knows what he's doing, but there was also many moments where it was a very cliche lucky moment that happened.
Yeah, definitely. I think in terms of cliches, I think like a lot of stuff came from this movie. I think like the whole, not to say there's been like a lot of movies like it since necessarily, but like the whole idea of an explorer, I think you think of, you know, Indiana Jones, and I think that like
you
that
think goes, of a whip and you,
yeah,
you think
exactly, of Indiana Jones. And a hat and, you know, a leather jacket and all those things. I think that's a testament to a good character being built. I'd kind of try to rush through some things because we're creeping up on an hour. Yeah, I think Cairo, like, there's a lot of creative fight choreography. And yeah, I don't know. It was like, it was cool to see a bunch of wide shots of people fighting and like clear stunts. There's like some great stunt work in this movie. Holy cow. And that includes like the explosions and everything, but there's some really good stunts and some really good moments of fighting as well. Another moment of just like, wow, they just showed everything that's about to happen without saying a single word was you have like a guy in like the white hat in the suit that looks evil in Cairo. Mm-hmm. And you have him like walk up to a bunch of dudes with masks on and like nod to them and they all run out of the room. Yeah. It's like, okay, they're about to go kill Indiana Jones. And like, that's like, they did all that without saying who these characters are because they didn't need to. They didn't need to tell you this guy was with the Nazis. It was clear. And so I thought that was cool to see. The Staff of Ra scene when he finds the room, the map room. I'm just in love with that scene. The miniature layout of the area on the ground. I love the detail that the Nazis wrote on the map. Like, they wrote where they thought the Ark was. I thought that was, like, another reminder of, like, the way they're thinking compared to how Indiana Jones thinks and how he respects what he's doing and they don't. And, yeah, just a cool climactic moment of the sun coming through the roof and going through the staff and the music. And, a cool anamorphic flare in that scene. Because there are only a few of them. They did not overuse it. They did not use it very much. Yeah, I said great stunts in VFX. There were people thrown from trucks, which is not easy to do, and they did it well. There were some really realistic squibs of blood when people got shot. A truck went off a mountain, which was cool. Likely done with a miniature, but it was still cool. Yeah, I mean, obviously the face melting at the end. And everything that happens in that scene was insanely well done. And I think in terms of stunt work, and I'm going to talk more about the makeup and everything, but in terms of the stunt work, I noticed this while he is thrown out the front windshield of a truck, holds onto the Mercedes sign on the truck, it bends and breaks off. He holds onto the grills of the truck, they bend and break off. He goes under the truck, literally goes under the truck and climbs under it and gets back in the front seat. Even this small moment is a story in itself, where there's a relief when he grabs onto an object, but it bends and breaks, and then it happens again. And then there's a solution. He crawls under the truck. And throughout every sequence of events in the whole movie, let's say the temple at the beginning, you have a story within that. There's a beginning, middle, and end of getting into the tomb, establishing there's danger with the spiders and the different traps, getting past a bunch of traps, and then thinking you have a moment of relief when he grabs the idol and nothing happens. And then the room starts to crumble, and then he runs away. And the boulder is the final climax, and he gets away from that. So every single scene, it seems, or every action sequence has a beginning and middle end, just like every story should. And that just strengthens the story. And I watched a little mini documentary about this a while back, and just shows how much thought they put into every single little moment in an action sequence. And they ditch stuff that doesn't work, and they, pick things that work better. And it's really well thought out. There's a scene where the car pulls up after they lose Indiana Jones on the truck, and you hear a dog barking, and then the Nazi throws a melon at the dog, and you hear the dog yelp and run away, but you never see the dog, which is interesting because that means, I don't know if it was in the script, but this guy threw a melon. And some sound guy put a dog yelping in there to show that he threw it at the dog. You never see it, just the sound. So I wonder if that was in the script or the sound guy having fun. Either way, it was great. Not that I like dogs being brutalized, but it was funny.
We do not support that.
The End of the Stuff podcast does not support that. Should I keep going, or do you want to jump in?
I just have some closing stuff. So if you're not there yet, then keep going.
Yeah, I'll keep going. It ends on a matte painting, which I love. The big room with the all of the top secret crates is just a big painting and a guy walking in the middle, which is an old practice. And I think it's just great that we saw, and I'm not giving credit. I gave so much credit to La La Land for using practicals. It's this is the most practical movie you've ever seen. And I'm about to go into more of that, but I'm not giving enough credit to just how many of the special effects and how much stuff was done practically without a single bit of CGI. And I guess I'll just go into that right now. You have the last scene where the arc opens and zaps everyone and melts faces and crushes them. And then, fire opens up to the skies and goes into the heavens. That fire was literally gunpowder burning, smokeless gunpowder. And they, enlarged it and slowed it down and put in the scene. And it's all just so real. And the Tote's head melting was a head made out of gelatin, and they put some turbine, some room heaters up to it, and put it on 24 times speed and watched the head melt. And that was really what happened. And then they stuck a vacuum in the other Nazi guy's head, and sucked the air out of his head, and it squished. And that's how you get that squishing effect. And it was a pretty violent movie for a PG movie, because there was no PG-13 back then. It was either PG or R. And Belloc, who has the rabbi outfit on, and he's scooping, he's the one that really touches the ark, his head explodes. And they threatened to give an R rating if they kept that in. So they put flames in front of the screen, and you can see his head explode behind the flames. But it was just a little bit less graphic, so it got a PG rating, which I think is so funny. The wisping woman flying around the room, that comes out of the ark, that was a model, an actual model, a woman who they painted, put makeup on, and they had her swim in a fish tank, a giant tank with veils on, so it looks like she's floating around. And then they sped up the footage a bit. They did the same thing with the skeleton model when she turns into a ghost, and kind of used puppets and dragged him around a fish tank. It's all done, and again, this is what I'm talking about last week with the camera panning back and forth for this really cool effect with Mia and Seb dancing and playing piano. It's these are things you can do at home. These are things that take such creativity and a lot of work, but you don't have to pay someone to do CGI for you, or you don't have to learn CGI and just give in and say, oh, this is just going to look bad. No, you can, to a certain extent, do whatever you want, and find creative solutions to do what you want. And yeah, it that was also done so well. I want to give credit to the makeup artist who was Chris Wallace. And yeah, it good job, Chris.
If you're out there, great.
Yeah, work. If you're listening to this, Chris, great job. I just have a couple of themes here. And
Chris, if you're listening, tell Harrison to give us a listen.
Yeah, ask him if he wants to be a guest. Actually, don't. I would not want to have Harrison Ford on.
That's a lot of pressure.
So
yeah.
Scary. So characters like Brody and Sala both told Indiana Jones to be weary of the Ark. It was like, this is like a powerful thing you're messing with. And, you know, we talked already about mm-hmm. how Indiana Jones is messing with it for seemingly the right reasons. He wants to give it to a museum. You know, it can be studied there. It's safe. It's not in the wrong hands. But they told him to be careful with it. And the translator who translated the Staff of Ra headpiece for them, you know, he translates and then like wind blows through the room and like there's like chimes and mm-hmm. stuff. And it's like you like feel this like power of God, I guess, that like is emanating, I guess. And then like you have like the storm behind them while they're digging up the Ark and, you know, the burning. The swastika is burned off of the box that the Ark's being held in, like mm-hmm. in the Nazi information. Like, it's all very symbolic, and like it comes down to, I think, the main theme of like corruption of power. And, you know, even Indiana Jones kind of had to let go of his obsession, and he did fight till the end to get it put in a museum and everything, and he did technically win and got it for the US and kept it from the Nazis. But, you know, he wanted to defeat the Nazis at one point by just blowing up the Ark and knew that he couldn't do that. And then at the end, it was so powerful that it was killing everybody in the room. He had to close his eyes and like resist it. And so did Marion. And it was like, he was the good guy who you think in your head, like the Ark's best in his hands. And you don't see him corrupted by it, which is, I think, is the point of the movie. Like, other people are corrupted by it, like the Nazis, especially, obviously. He almost submitted to its power, and as if he would have been corrupted by it, you know. And even though he was obsessed with getting in the museum, I think ultimately, it was almost like too great for even that to happen in a way. And yeah, it's like just, I guess, classic like good versus evil, but I think it's a little bit more interesting than that because it is this good guy, Indiana Jones, who is wrestling with this like supernatural object that I think even mm-hmm. in his goodness can't necessarily tame, I guess mm-hmm. is the right way to put it. But yeah, I think that was well built by like his friends and the people around him telling him like, you need to be careful. And he's like, are you kidding? This is the whole movie's like, it's not a big deal. It's just a piece of gold. But then mm-hmm. is humbled a bit and learns to respect it, I think. But yeah.
Yeah.
That's pretty much my notes.
All right. Yeah, I just wanted to tack on at the end here. John Williams, another classic soundtrack. It was really interesting. There were a lot of moments in the soundtrack that sounded very similar to Star Wars. Just like chord progressions or just like a resolution to a different note or something like that. That gave me a lot of Star Wars vibes. One specifically that I wrote down was the ending scene of Marion. Is that the name, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Marion and Indiana on the stairs after they deliver the piece in the Capitol or whatever government building that is. Just the music that was playing there, it gave me just like a little Star Wars feeling of like a Han and Leia kind of scene, if I remember correctly, which I thought was interesting. And it's really cool to see John Williams like carry those different things from film to film. And then lastly, the ending, I mean, you talked a lot about it. Pretty cool. I will say that it happened like fairly quickly for me. I don't know. It just felt like I like I was watching it, I looked down at my watch for 2 seconds, I look back up and it's basically over already.
You mean like the actual scene of everyone dying, like, yeah, was too fast?
Yeah.
Gotcha.
And I don't know, it felt like a little unexplained to me. We don't necessarily, I mean, unless you really want to, we don't have to talk a lot about it, but I was just saying, like, it, let's like talk about we get the build. I will say that my computer's almost dead. So
okay.
We can talk and then I'll give a warning. But it seems a little unexplained. Like, we spend the whole movie talking about how this thing is able to talk to God. Like, you're able to talk to God through the Lost Ark. And, like, we get there and they open it up and you see, like, the light or the fire coming through and you're like, oh, they're about to talk to God and something bad's going to happen. And then next thing you know, everyone's getting, like, disintegrated and, like, blown to pieces. And it felt kind of unexplained to me. Maybe I just missed a bit where they were talking about it.
I don't think it's really explained. It's like there's this object. It's like about humility and, like, quelling this, like, thirst for power, because it's like that's all Hitler wanted was power and to be able to control, like, that.
Yeah,
that was Hitler, and that were the Nazis. Are you, like, maybe gonna run out of power?
I have, like, a few more minutes, but maybe it's more just like a, like you said, it wasn't explained, and maybe it doesn't need explained.
I think it is just a symbol. It doesn't really need explaining, but I think it's a symbol of, like, there are things that shouldn't be given to people. It's like Prometheus and fire. It's like, mm-hmm. It's like there are, the Nazis wanted this ultimate power to be able to control the world, and that's what the Ark symbolized. And they couldn't handle it. It was like, that's not how the world works. That's not what you get. And Indiana Jones also, like, had to, like, not that he was even trying to control the world with it, but he had to close his eyes. It wasn't even for the good people to possess.
Yeah.
It was like there's something above. It was like above good and evil. It was like, this isn't for anybody to, like, control the world. This isn't for anybody to dominate anyone. I think that's mm-hmm. what it symbolized mostly.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. Just a, like, unspoken thing of powerful people looking for more power, and that shouldn't necessarily be happening. So
right.
Yeah, I think that's all I got. The long episode, long enough to where my computer battery is weird. I don't know that this has ever happened before. Maybe I just got another program running in the back or something. But
what's the episode for next week?
That felt really good, honestly. Like that talk, that was a pretty good.
It was fast paced.
Was very very quick. But yeah, the movie for next week, it's a movie that Michael and I have both seen before. It's a classic. My dad will be proud of me for picking this one. and I think I forget what I was going to say. Anyway, the movie that I will be picking for next week is Ocean's 11, which Michael mentioned in the middle of the podcast. Starring George Clooney, he'll have his second appearance in season 4,
mm-hmm.
and Brad Pitt. Has Brad Pitt been in yet?
I have no idea. I can't.
Well, I've lost track. We're just gonna have to do a tally at the end. That's all it is. But yeah, that is it. You can find it on HBO Max or you can rent it on Amazon Prime. So
yeah. Thank you guys so much for listening. If there's anything, what, Aiden?
And last week we mentioned Michael picked up a guest for our last episode of the season. Another announcement, we've picked up a guest for the second to last episode of the season. So back-to-back weeks, two guests for two of our favorite films, I would say.
No, it's not one of my favorite for you. Movies.
Okay, no. For me, it would be my favorite film. So excited for that. And I think you guys will enjoy who we have.
Yeah,
totally. And I think it'll be a cool experience for the both of us as well. So,
yeah, thank you guys so much for your support. Thank you for listening. If you have any extra stuff you want to talk about with Raiders of the Lost Ark, I'm sure you won't, but feel free to reach out to us and tell us your thoughts. Thank you guys again, and I just hope you guys have a great week.
Peace.